We're in London with Peter Tatchell, the director of the Peter Tatchell Foundation, and we're here to get his spin on our LGBTQ issues in the UK and globally. Hi, Peter.
Very glad to join you.
First of all, tell us a little bit about history about the campaigns that you've been working on.
Well, I came out and began campaigning for LGBT plus rights way back in 1969. When I was 17 years old. So I've been doing this for almost 50 years. And of course, when I began, it was very different from what it is now. In countries like Britain and Australia, homosexuality was still very heavily repressed. The medical and psychiatric profession still designated homosexuality as an illness, a sickness that required curing. There was hardly any visible public figures who are LGB or T. So it really was a different era entirely. And it's been my incredible honor and privilege to be part of this long process post-Stonewall to have changed not just the laws, but the culture, the values, the attitudes.
What inspires you to do the work that you do?
I love other people. I love freedom, justice, and equality. I want to see every person on this planet, regardless of their sexuality or gender identity, to have respect, dignity, and equal rights. So for me, LGBT plus rights is part of the broader spectrum of human rights. And so I stand in solidarity with the struggle of women, black and ethnic minority peoples, the disabled, and people who are persecuted because of their faith or their non-faith.
What would you like to accomplish with your work?
When I began in the late 1960s as a teenager, my goal was to make the LGBT movement redundant. In other words, to win, not just in countries like Britain, but all across the world, the freedom and equality that LGBT plus people deserve. And when we win that, then there'll be no need for a movement. So my goal is to make myself and my movement redundant.
What is your personal commitment to LGBTQ equality?
Well, I have worked through, in the early days, the Gay Liberation Front, in the 1990s with Outrage, the Queer Rights Direct Action Group, and now as director of my own small human rights foundation, the Peter Tatchell Foundation, which works on both LGBT plus rights, but also on other human rights issues as well, supporting the struggle for democracy and human rights in countries like Russia, Pakistan, Uganda, and many others. It's very interesting the way in which my work on non-LGBT issues has inadvertently helped raise the profile and awareness of LGBT rights. For example, I've done a lot of work supporting the democracy movement in Pakistan, and in particular the national liberation struggle of the people of Balochistan, who've been occupied by Pakistan since the late 1940s. And because I am a gay man, an openly gay man, and because I support LGBT rights, even without mentioning it, this has created an awareness, a mind change among many people in Pakistan who previously had never met an openly gay person and who, regarded LGBT people as demons or whatever. Because I've supported their struggle, it's helped bring about a change in values and attitudes, a much more sympathetic attitude towards LGBT plus rights.
What would you like to see happen for LGBTQ equality in the UK?
Well, until 1999, Britain had by volume the largest number of anti-gay laws of any country in the world, some of them dating back centuries. But since 1999, in fact, within 15 years of 1999, all those major anti-gay laws have been abolished. So we have achieved an enormous, extraordinary, phenomenal change. And that's down not just to the tens of thousands of LGBT plus people who've been involved, but also, very importantly, our straight friends and allies. So here we are now. Britain has some of the best laws in the world. But there's still battles to be won. We've got marriage equality in England, Scotland and Wales, but not yet in Northern Ireland. We still don't have a requirement on schools to teach about LGBT issues in HIV education and in sex and relationship education. Even today, although it's better than it was, lots of LGBT refugees who flee to Britain from viciously homophobic countries like Bangladesh, Nigeria, and so on, they are often refused, often denied the asylum, the refuge to which they're entitled. So we have on a range of issues still work to do.
How do you see our LGBTQ community moving forward in this backlash of conservative world leaders?
There are about 20 or 30 countries where we are going through a period of extreme homophobic backlash. Countries like Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Indonesia, which never before had a history of overt, organized persecution of LGBT plus people. And then there are other countries where there's a historic pattern of persecution, like Russia, Cameroon, and so on. My feeling is that backlash is tragic. It's wrong. It's unforgivable. But it's only in about 20 to 30 countries out of 193. So it's still a very small minority. Moreover, backlash is a sign that we're winning. If we weren't making gains, if we weren't challenging, then those people in power who are stepping up their persecution would ignore us. They wouldn't bother. It's only because we're making waves and winning successes that this backlash has come. It's very similar to the backlash against the Black Civil Rights Movement in America in the 1960s. When the Freedom Riders went into the Deep South, the number of violent attacks and lynchings of Black people actually increased. Sad and tragic though that was, it was something that the African American communities had to go through in order to finally win an end to segregation and the suppression of voting rights. So I look at the backlash against LGBT plus people in the same kind of perspective. It's awful, it's dreadful, but it's a sign that we are making waves and that we will eventually win.
With LGBTQ teens are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers after facing bullying incidents, what advice would you have for these kids dealing with these times?
It's true that the levels of depression, anxiety, self-harm, and even actual suicide are much higher among LGBT young people than their straight counterparts. And that is clearly an indictment of homophobia, biphobia, and transphobia. But I would say to young people, awful though it may be, you are a good and worthy person. Get help and support from teenage LGBT groups. You know, get involved with the LGBT community to find support and solidarity. And know that in the end, you will get through this. That you will survive. But to society, my message is, you have to do more to challenge bullying and hate crime against LGBT plus people. And that starts in our schools. We need education about equality and diversity in every school by law in order to challenge not just anti-LGBT prejudice, but also racism, misogyny, disablism, and all other forms of prejudice. Research shows that schools that do these education programs, it results in much lower levels of bullying, and those young people tend to grow up to be adults who are much more understanding and accepting of people in their life who happen to be LGBT plus, fellow employees, their neighbors, and so on. So education, to me, is a really important and fundamental in terms of tackling both hate crime and bullying, but also the levels of depression, anxiety, and self-harm.
How can people get information about your work?
They can go to my foundation's website, www.petertatchellfoundation.org. There you'll see a vast array of information about the different campaigns and issues we work on. It'll tell you about the casework we do, helping individuals who are victims of homophobia, biphobia, and transphobia. And if you're really interested, in the top right-hand corner, there's a little button called Join Us. You can click on there, give us your email address, and we'll send you regular bulletins. It's all free.
What other projects are you working on?
One of the things that we think is really important is that sex and relationship education should be mandatory in every school, and it should be inclusive of LGBT plus issues. We're also pressing the government, the UK government, to revise the immigration and asylum system to ensure that LGBT plus people fleeing persecution abroad are granted a safe haven in this country. We are supporting the campaign for marriage equality in the north of Ireland, where it still is totally banned. And we're also striving very hard to get the Bank of England to agree that the new person on the £50 banknote should be Alan Turing, the mathematical genius, wartime codebreaker, and founder of modern computing. He is one of the greatest scientists in history, and we believe that he deserves to be on this banknote, all the more so because he was gay and persecuted and eventually driven to suicide because of it.
Is there a question you wish people would ask you?
I guess partly to help and inspire others, the question would be, why do you do what you do? So for me, it's very simple. I have never believed that LGBT plus rights are just for people in Britain, the United States, or Australia. I've always believed it's a universal global struggle. And I remember doing my first international campaign way back in 1971 against the then Cuban government persecution and roundup of homosexual people. For me, queer solidarity globally is so important. And it's particularly important that people in Western countries stand in solidarity with those in the global South who are often operating in countries where there is no democracy or human rights, where they are at great risk of imprisonment, torture, and even execution. Those people are my inspirations. They give me the inspiration and the motivation to keep fighting for LGBT plus rights. I think it's really important that we stand in solidarity and support their struggles.
Tell us about your experience this year in Russia.
In 2018, Russia hosted the Football World Cup, and I thought it was really important to use this opportunity to highlight the ongoing persecution of LGBT plus people in Chechnya, which is part of the Russian Federation. So on the opening day of the World Cup, I staged a one-person protest by the Kremlin, calling out President Putin over his failure to stop the persecution of LGBT plus people in Chechnya. It didn't last very long. I was fairly swiftly arrested. I spent an hour or so in detention, but eventually, thanks to the intervention of the British Embassy, I was released. For me, what was really important was that that protest was reported all over the world. So it raised public awareness about the persecution of LGBT plus people in Chechnya. But also, for me, it was very important that the Russian LGBT activists saw the protest I did as a gesture of solidarity. It gave them a great emotional and moral boost. They made it clear to me they could not do it because the consequences would be so severe. But they were really glad that I did it and that I helped, through my actions, get the persecution of LGBT plus people in Chechnya into the news and into public awareness.
Can you tell us about some of the highlights of your campaigns over the decades?
One of my earliest high-profile campaigns was in 1972, when I interrupted a lecture by Professor Hans Eysenck, who at the time was one of the world's most famous psychologists. He was advocating electric shock aversion therapy to cure homosexuality, claiming, quote, "It doesn't hurt very much. It's just like a visit to the dentist." The following year, I staged the first LGBT plus protest in a communist country in what was then East Germany, in East Berlin, to highlight the persecution of LGBT plus people globally, but particularly in the communist bloc, which was headed, of course, in those days by the then Soviet Union. A bit later, in 1993, I stood as a left-wing Labour candidate in the Bermondsey by-election, where I set out the most radical, comprehensive programme for LGBT rights ever produced by any candidate, I think, before and possibly even since. I lost that election. It's generally regarded as being the most violent and dirty and homophobic of any election in Britain in the 20th century. Later on, in 1987, I founded the first organisation dedicated to the human rights of people with HIV and AIDS, and drafted an AIDS and Human Rights Charter, which we put to the World Health Minister Summit in London in January 1988, and got them to agree a statement deploring discrimination and persecution against people living with HIV. 2 years later, together with about 30 other people, I co-founded the LGBT Queer Rights Direct Action Group Outrage, which became really the most prominent LGBT organisation in Britain at that time, doing a vast range of direct action protests and civil disobedience to challenge homophobia, biphobia and transphobia. This included, in 1994, naming 10 Church of England bishops and calling on them to tell the truth about their sexuality. They were preaching every Sunday that we should all tell the truth, but they weren't telling the truth. And moreover, they were colluding with a church which was historically and contemporarily anti-gay. The upshot of that was that the then Archbishop of Canterbury set up, for the first time, a formal dialogue between the Church of England and the LGBT plus community. That had never happened before. Plus, the House of Bishops passed the strongest ever declaration against homophobia. So a direct correlation between our naming and shaming and these two positive concrete results. 4 years later, in 1998, Outrage went to Canterbury Cathedral on Easter Sunday and interrupted the then Archbishop's Easter sermon over his support for legal discrimination against LGBT plus people. He was saying that homosexuality is inferior to heterosexuality, and therefore it was correct that the law should discriminate against LGBT plus people. The upshot was that he personally, for the first time ever, met with the lesbian and gay Christian movement. And on top of that, it prompted several bishops to make public declarations of their support for equal LGBT human rights. In 1999, myself and three other members of Outrage ambushed the president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, outside his hotel. We forced his motorcade to halt in the street and placed him under arrest on charges of torture. Mugabe was homophobic, but we were targeting him over his torture of his own people, because the laws against torture exist in British law and international law. We did not succeed, but it did raise public awareness through news coverage all around the world. And judging from the responses of people inside Zimbabwe, they said it was a great psychological and emotional boost for them to know that people in the outside world knew and cared about the shocking inhumanities that Mugabe was perpetrating. There was a second attempt by me as a lone individual to arrest Mugabe in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel in Brussels 2 years later in 2001, which resulted in me being beaten unconscious by his bodyguards. Not what I wanted or expected, but boy, that was great, great, great PR for the campaign against Mugabe, because it showed what a brute he was. Most people said, if he's prepared to have his bodyguards beat unconscious a peaceful protester in the centre of a European capital city in broad daylight in front of TV cameras, just imagine what he's doing to his own people when no one is watching. The following year, 2002, I went to Memphis, Tennessee, to challenge Mike Tyson over his misogyny and homophobia. I lay in wait outside his gym, and as he arrived, I ambushed him and challenged him face to face. In the end, extraordinarily, Tyson pleaded that it was just banter. He didn't really mean it. He sort of apologized. But most significantly, I got him to make a public statement saying he was opposed to discrimination against LGBT people. Up until that time, and barely ever since, has any world-class boxer ever made such a declaration. Working in collaboration with the Jamaican LGBT group JFLAG, from 2004, Outrage organized and coordinated the Stop Murder Music campaign, which targeted 8 Jamaican reggae and dancehall singers who put out lyrics advocating the killing of LGBT plus people. We tried to have a dialogue with them, but they refused. We appealed to their reason and compassion, but were knocked aside. So we decided to organise a boycott campaign against their concerts and to target concert promoters and venues to get their concerts cancelled. We succeeded, not just in Britain, but also in the United States and Canada, in France, Germany, Australia, and many other countries. These artists lost millions and millions of pounds of income. But the upshot was they first reduced and then stopped their murder music. So it shows that this kind of direct action campaigning really does work. In 2007, at the invitation of Russian LGBT activists, I went to Moscow to support their bid to hold a Moscow Pride parade, which was lawful under the Russian constitution, which guarantees freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech. The Moscow mayor banned the Pride parade and ordered us all to be arrested. I managed to escape from the police, but was later set upon by neo-Nazis and beaten almost unconscious, while Moscow City Police stood there with folded arms and watched. When I was on the ground, losing consciousness, then they stepped in and arrested me, while my assailants were allowed to walk free. When I was taken to the police van, I noticed that at one point, one of the main assailants walked up to the police lines and showed some form of ID. The Russian activist said this means he was almost certainly either a plainclothes police officer or a neo-Nazi acting in cahoots with the police. In 2010, Outrage founded and coordinated the Equal Love campaign. This had twin objectives with the aim of uniting LGBT plus and straight people together. So that the twin objectives were first to overturn the ban on lesbian and gay couples marrying, and also to overturn the ban on heterosexual couples from having a civil union. We said that both these bans were wrong. So we began that campaign in 2010. We eventually persuaded the Conservative government, against its traditions and history, to support equal marriage. And we finally got that. We finally won it in 2013.
Do you have a favorite quote or mantra to get you through difficult times?
My mantra is, don't accept the world as it is. Dream of what the world could be, and then help make it happen. It means that we should never accept things as they are. If things as they are bad, we need to imagine something better, and then work together collectively to help secure that achievement.